everybody. Welcome to the Hallmarkies podcast. We're really excited today to be here with a special bonus episode where we are going to be talking with director Tor Freudenthal. And we were able to have an interview with Zach, our friend of our podcast, about the movie Words on Bathroom Walls. And Tor is the director of that film. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely, Rachel. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So what we've been doing lately is just been asking our guests to tell us, how have you been handling this time of quarantine, this kind of crazy time? Have you been doing any quarantine baking or anything like that?
I wish I could bake. We're just sort of sequestered at the house. We have a 2.5-year-old, so he keeps us on our toes.
Yeah,
doing a bunch of reading, exercising. I love to run. So, I do that to stay sane. Here in Los Angeles, we had these fires that are still ongoing. So we sort of took that as an opportunity to get out and take a needed vacation. So we went to Arizona for like 10 days, where the air was clear and it was beautiful. And that was nice to get away. So other than that, just, reading, watching stuff, trying to unsuccessfully tune out the news as much as possible.
Have you binged anything good?
Yes. So my favorite thing probably this year was a show on Hulu made by the BBC. It's called Normal People.
It's
incredible. It's a simple love story, beautifully acted. I can highly recommend it. If you're missing some sort of human interaction and emotional closeness, this will give it to you. It's beautiful.
Cool. That sounds really good. Did you watch McMillions?
I have not.
Oh,
no.
So good. That's my favorite. Of all the things that I binged, that was my favorite. And it's because it's the first thing that I binged during quarantine.
Right.
But it's so entertaining. It's a docu-series, but it's really good.
I also currently I'm watching The Vow. Not a particularly lighthearted thing, but it's magnetic. I mean, you can't turn your eyes from it.
They're good at doing that.
Well done.
Yeah. On HBO and Netflix. Well, so we had talked just briefly before, and you told me that you actually started out with your studies in animation.
Yes, and I know that you're a big lover of animation.
Huge animation fan. I've been a writer over at rotoscopers.com for 5 years. Over my other content, I talk all about animation. So that was very exciting for me. You studied at CalArts.
I did, yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, my first love really as a kid was drawing. I was like, I grew up in Berlin in Germany, so I fell in love with this sort of French Belgian comics,
Tintin
and Asterix. Later on, when I was a little older, I absolutely adored Mobius, the artist, still do. So I thought I was going to be a maker of graphic novels. So I drew like crazy. My dad's a visual artist and a painter. So I was surrounded by that, and he taught me a lot about art and art history, and we drew a lot together. And I was making comics. So when I was a teenager in high school, I was able to like sell some of these short stories, maybe 5 or 6 pages long, to magazines. And that was sort of, that's where my heart was. I was watching films, but I didn't consider it back then as a thing to do. I didn't know how to do it. But when I started becoming more interested, the first thing I turned to, because I was drawing, was animation. So the art school I went to didn't have an animation class or someone to teach me how to do it, but they did have this like Oxbury camera, the old animation stand type thing in a basement. And so I read books, you know, there's a, I think it was like Preston Blair or something, or, and then a book by Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson, The Illusion of Life. So I tried to sort of teach myself how to do it. And I made a couple of short films, which then led to getting accepted to CalArts. So I moved across the Atlantic and my life completely changed. You know, I was suddenly in California. It was an exchange program I got into, and the plan was to stay 1 year, and I loved it so much that I just stayed and, you know, got out of school, worked. By that time, I sort of, it was an ongoing long and winding road of discovery of what I wanted to do, and things fell by the wayside. I sort of, through learning animation at CalArts, I really got this, you know, the basics of storytelling back then in film, but also maybe intuitively understood that I was not going to be great at sitting at a desk by myself for a long time. You know, animation is a very sort of very, very detailed kind of, you know, labor intensive process. And I knew.
Years.
Yes. And I knew I didn't really want to be sort of an animator or maybe work at a giant company where, you know, you're lucky to, you know, do a little part of the storytelling maybe. And over a long period of time, I've seen friends of mine who I graduated with go through that process. Mm-hmm. It takes a long while until you get to tell your own story, if ever, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but what I did learn, what's amazing about animation and the reason I think animated movies on average are so good is that they're essentially, there's a trial and error process. They are mostly sort of made, or they're edited before they're made, you know? So you get to throw sequences up in chicken scratch and, you know, realize they don't work and then take them down and start anew. So that's why I think the you know, movies made by Pixar or Disney are so watertight.
Yeah.
On average.
Well, the whole idea of the brain trust,
yeah,
and things getting perfected over years, because most movies are made in a couple of, as far as the shooting of it, it's made in a couple of months,
yes,
and if weeks, if you're talking, you know, made for TV movies, and whereas you know, animated films take years, yeah, to make, and so it's a different thing, and people might not, that aren't a kind of up in the animation scene, might not realize that CalArts has produced practically every big name, yes, animator,
yeah,
that people like Alex Hirsch, who did Gravity Falls, mm-hmm, Genndy Kartakoski, Craig McCracken, who did Powerpuff Girls. I mean, just the list goes on and on.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was a beautiful experience going there. The teachers were amazing. Also that feeling that everybody was sort of in love with the same thing and pulling in the same direction. So mm-hmm, that the, you know, if there was competition, it was always really founded in, you know, the adoration of the medium,
mm-hmm,
and trying to, you know, inspire each other to be better at it.
And it's just such an amazing time to be an animation fan, because I mean, I've thought about it a lot that in the 80s, I mean, there were years where they didn't have a single animated film, zero, not one, right, released, which is crazy. And, you know, and you'd have some, you know, one or two maybe. And we regularly have, you know, 30 animated right. films released. Absolutely. I mean, it's just amazing. And that's not even including all the television work. It's just people have nostalgia for, you know, for the old animated television shows. But in my opinion, I think it's just getting better and better and better. And I mean, just in my opinion, even something like you look at the new DuckTales versus the old DuckTales, it's mm-hmm. way better.
I also think it's like, it's getting narratively and stylistically more diverse, and maybe thanks to, you know, places like Netflix, who are taking chances with some adult sort of driven content. I remember like at CalArts, Brad Bird came to talk to us 1 year, and he, and I'll never forget this. He said, you know, animation is not a genre.
Right.
Shouldn't be seen as a genre, meaning the kids' genre. To him, it was a medium in which to tell stories. And, you know, he's shown that time and again that, you know, you can, you know, deal with, you know, even in a sort of comedic sense with adult themes.
Yeah.
And I think now he's working on something that's more adult driven, which I hope gets made.
That would be amazing. Yeah. I mean, you look at something like BoJack Horseman.
I love that.
As an example.
Yeah.
There's a lot of more mature animation that's coming out and being received well. And so it's a really exciting time to be an animation fan. And it's kind of cool in the, you know, age of this crazy year that animation is, when everything was closed, animation was one of the things that could keep going forward.
Yes.
And people could keep working on it within reason, not every part of it, of course, but it's kind of, they even had the show The Blacklist. They I guess they even had the final, they couldn't film the final episode of the season, so they ended up doing it animated.
Wow. I did not know that. What a great idea.
Yeah, which is really cool.
That's cool.
So anyway, we could talk the entire podcast just about all this geeky animation stuff.
Probably, yeah.
But you had your first feature, at least according to IMDb, though, what I saw was Hotel for Dogs. And that seems like a pretty big feature, like for your first one, to not have to do some like, you know, obscure indie kind of a thing. Like, that's pretty cool.
My obscure indies were, I guess, commercials and short films. Like I, you know, what I did out of CalArts is I got a job basically working as a concept artist, doing everything from storyboards to, you know, working for set design to designing characters. And I did that for a couple of years and did short films along the way, like little spec pieces, which got me ultimately into commercial directing. So I was signed to the roster of a commercial production house. And that was, you know, my second film school, really. You know, I had, you know, I learned a lot of theoretical stuff working on big movies within the context of my first job, but never actually you know, directed on the floor. And that's what commercials sort of did for me. I directed probably for like 4 or 5 years. I did stuff in Europe. I worked in the United States. So I did, you know, Campbell's Soup, Nike, you know, Foot Locker, and, you know, Florida's Natural Orange Juice, like you name it. And it was very educational. It doesn't really equip you. It doesn't teach you long form storytelling at all. But what it did for me was, like, you know, help me get a handle on working with a crew, you know, keeping a timetable, being responsible in the eyes of the agency and the client you work with, which is really like, you know, so almost like a producer studio situation if you translate it to studio filmmaking. And I made a short along the way that went to Sundance. So all the combination of that work got me into rooms with people on a studio level to talk about films. And there were a couple of like false starts, but then Hotel for Dogs came around. It was a matter of like, I'll do it. You know, like, give me a movie to do, you know, Maybe a different mindset that I'm in today, but it was a wonderful maiden voyage. The studio was DreamWorks, which is now Amblin Partners. And it was a great, great experience. You know, got to cast some wonderful actors like Don Cheadle and Lisa Kudrow and a very, very young Emma Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still sort of trying to figure out how to tell a story, honestly.
Like, yeah, I mean, they say never, you want to avoid working with animals and avoid working with kids. And you did both for your first
Yes. And it, you know, that there's different difficulties. The animals were incredible, meaning their sort of symbiotic relationship with the trainers were just mind-boggling. The one thing I had to do is make a lot of decisions in advance of what I wanted the dogs to do and how we could communicate emotions, because there was no CG. There was no talking animals, you know, or you know, manipulating their faces at all. It was just them. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, I had to sit down with trainers maybe 3 weeks in advance and say, well, this scene, what can we do to convey, you know, sadness in this dog? And they made suggestions like, you know, he could put his head or chin down to his paw and look up, you know, things like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, okay, let's do it like this. And then they need a couple of weeks to acclimate the dog, to make the dog get used to the idea of what he does in the scene. And then once the day came around, we did the scene. It was, you know, it worked really well. They were amazing.
Yeah.
And they can work longer than the minors, the human minors, meaning the children in the film, which, you know, labor laws dictate, obviously, that you can't have them, depending on age, either past 6 hours or 8 hours. So it was a good exercise in like telling the story, and sometimes telling the story really quickly with the time that I had.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So then you did Diary of a Wimpy Kid, and that must have been fun because there is animation in that.
Yes. I was really in love with these books when I sort of talked with the producers, Nina Jacobson and Brad Simpson, who made the movie with me. I had actually sort of, because I was drawing as a kid, I had sort of done my own diaries of a wimpy kid in a way. Like, they were not as much like the Greg Heffley diaries in the movie, which recount day-to-day, you know, happenings in school and life. They were sometimes verging into sort of the fantastical, but I was always drawing and writing stuff. And I brought these diaries to our meeting, because I was like, there definitely is a parallel, you know, between sometimes, you know, having this outlet of drawing and working through stuff on the page that I wasn't able to do maybe in my day-to-day life. So I could relate to that in the film. And we, you know, we had, the challenge of that movie was that the books are very episodic, if you will, you know, one day this happens, the next day this happens. And we were working to make this a story about a kid who makes a number of very wrong decisions, and then, you know, in the course of it, loses his best friend and has to see the error of his ways and get him back. So it was a more sort of, you know, had a more pronounced story arc than maybe the books, but we tried to definitely get the feel of the books in there. And the animation, cutting to his diary, and even doing things like direct address to the camera, which, you know, I did again in words on bathroom walls in a very, very different way. All that sort of helped, you know, I guess bring the character, or create a direct line between the character and the audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I think that we don't get enough live action quality films for kids, mm-hmm. particularly for like a little bit older kids. I feel like there's a lot of stuff that's for teenagers, and there's a lot of stuff that's for little kids. Mm-hmm. But that sort of in between phase, I feel like they're kind of either they end up liking stuff that's maybe a little too old for them, or like, you know, they're stuck with stuff that's too young. And so I appreciated that about the Wimpy Kid movies, and there's a lot of animation, but just having a live action story that about a kid they can relate to, I think is cool.
Right.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's talk about Words on Bathroom Walls. This is the recent release. When I went and saw it, I knew nothing about it. I just was anxious to get back in the theater. And I was able to go safely. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really well done. I'm a big advocate, I guess, for trying to remove the stigma that we have about mental illness, and that we're unwilling to talk about it, that we're embarrassed about it. All that stuff is just so frustrating to me.
Yeah.
And so this movie really struck home to me. And so I really appreciated that you made it. And I when I wrote my review, I said I'd love to know how this feels and how it's responded, how somebody with schizophrenia responds to it, because I have no way of knowing that. I'm just guessing. And so then Zach, he emailed me, and he really liked my review and he liked the movie. And so he came on, and I'll put a link down to that interview in the description. Anyway, it's just been a really great experience hearing his experience and how much he loved the movie. And so I think you all have a lot to be very proud of with it.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, Rachel, this interview was amazing for me to hear. In the last couple of weeks since the film's come out, I've gotten messages, you know, from people who either have a family member suffering from the illness, or, you know, are themselves people with schizophrenia. And, you know, a lot of them say they feel really great about being respected or being seen, and for this film to not use this illness as a means to create cinematic suspense or danger or fear. Exactly. Like, our main goal was always in making this movie to show the person behind the illness, and be respectful of them and empathetic to them. And here's why this, listening to Zach talk about his experience with it in detail, is so meaningful. This film was made with a lot of love by a lot of people. You know, mm-hmm. we immersed ourselves in this subject matter. We had, you know, during the making of it, you know, more than one medical advisor on board who, you know, went through the script and gave us pointers or suggestions. You know, I talked with therapists who deal with youth with schizophrenia specifically, you know, and work with those patients. I talked with families who have to live with a diagnosis, because so much of the film is about how it affects our lead character's relationships within the family unit, which he sees as being, you know, fraught and, you know, circumstances. If you see the movie, you know, he finds he himself is in danger or being challenged. You know, there's a lot of sort of testimonials you can find or people with the illness talking about their experience. I read a couple of books, one of which I really want to recommend. It's called The Center Cannot Hold by a woman named Ellen R. Sachs, who also has a TED Talk on the subject. She's kind of one of the success stories of a person living with schizophrenia. She's a tenured law professor at USC, and she's lived with this through most of her adult life, really. And the book goes into great detail about her psychosis episodes she's had, and also how it has affected her friendships. And that book was so educational. For anyone who wants to learn more about this, pick it up. You know, I had a nice little email exchange with her before I made the movie. And then after it was done, she watched it and very graciously made herself available to interview two of my cast members, Charlie Plummer and Molly Parker. You can find that, I think, on the Facebook page of the film. My point is, though, that even with this knowledge and all the information, at the end of the day, I had to make a sort of creative choice of how to portray this in a accessible way in a audiovisual creative medium, essentially. It's a storytelling medium, and portray this illness, the symptoms of which are about as manifold and varied as the human brains on this planet, you know? So at the end of the day, it's sort of a decision going out on a limb of making certain sort of aesthetic choices of how you show this illness in a way that is an invitation to keep watching and to understand it, even for completely uninitiated people, and get on board. And this is the most important thing: emotionally, always be invested in what happens with Adam and understand what he's going through. So it's a, you know, it's a conceit. It's our version of it, or our interpretation of it, if you will. And because of that, it felt really gratifying to hear Zach talk about how he connected with it, and that it, you know, essentially does a service to opening minds and, you know, and at least being a conversation starter.
It's the powerful nature of art. That's why we need to, like, we really need to fight to keep theaters. We need to keep them, you know, going, because the whole transformative process of from the filmmaker all the way down to the viewer, to the critic, to all the different people involved, it changes who you are. And I was actually talking, I was emailing with Zach the other day, and he said that now he's feeling so encouraged that he's going to start up a blog about his experiences. And so this is just, it's just so exciting.
That is amazing. Yeah. That is amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Zach. I mean, like, as I said, when I retweeted your podcast, I was like, this is exactly the conversations we need to be having in a destigmatizing, open way. So if the movie can contribute a little bit to making that happen, we've done our job.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, so what was it like as far as casting in the movie? So you have Charlie Plummer as the lead, and he's somebody I just absolutely loved, Lean on Pete, the film he had previously done. And so he's somebody that's been on my radar. And I've said, you know, flying time, that I think he's kind of the next Leonardo DiCaprio.
I was going to say the same thing. Yes, a lot of people during the shoot saw that parallel. Yeah.
I think he's super talented. And so how did you end up getting to cast Charlie?
So I had seen Lean on Pete as well, and another movie called King Jack that he did when he was even younger. And then, of course, the Ridley Scott movie, All the Money in the World. Mm-hmm. So it was very clear when our partners on the movie, LD Entertainment, who are Mickey Liddell and Pete Shilimon, basically said, we're making this, that we were not going to make it with if we couldn't find an actor who could embody all these different sides of Adam kind of seamlessly. I mean, this is a tough acting job, you know, because he has, for Charlie, throughout the shoot, it was a roller coaster because the shoot is very fast. I think we did this in like 25 days or something. And he was up one day and down the other, you know, because the movie is a roller coaster now, you know, imagine you have to act it all out. You know, there's a lightness to the movie. There's, you know, Adam in his more sort of tender, relaxed moments. And then there's, you know, a sort of descent into psychosis. So, you know, I just feel incredibly lucky to have gotten Charlie to do this. We sent him the script. At that point, there was no audition process for him. And I think he read it over the weekend and signaled his interest. And I had a conversation with him over Skype. And then he, you know, we saw eye to eye and off we went. The thing about him is, like, as a director, you have certain, you can't help but have the movie in your head in a certain way, you know? And what was refreshing about Charlie is, like, with all my planning and all our discussions, at the end of the day, I was more surprised than not sometimes at his choices. There was one particular thing I'll never forget. There's a scene, and I don't want to spoil it, but towards the end of the second act, where he is having he's having a very heated argument with his parents, and certain things start to happen in the room that signal to us that, you know, this is not, you know, 100% the reality that everybody else sees. We're in his head. So when I rehearsed the scene with him and the actors and sort of blocked it out, meaning determining the movement of the scene, he almost didn't do anything in rehearsal. It was always like, you know, he had a quiet mutter at best when he said his dialogue. And I realized, oh, he's just warming up, or he's not sort of spending himself on the rehearsal. And then once the camera rolls, it was like, oh my, like Charlie Plummer, the hurricane tornado. And it was at that point where, as a director, I turned into kind of an audience member, you know, of like experiencing his interpretation of that. And I'll never forget it. And it's like, it teaches you to, you know, hold the reins very steady, but also, you know, give room and let them sort of bring themselves to it.
Yeah,
and surprise you. Exactly. And all the actors did that. Like I it's a project where I, in the acting department, I don't see a weak link. I was, you know, we did our due diligence obviously with casting, but then once you see the whole ensemble kind of work together, you're like, you know, hallelujah, it's working, yeah. You know?
So the next question will be admittedly kind of spoilery. So if people listening want to skip ahead, they might want to do that. But so I have to ask, to me, the most impactful moment of the movie was when he reads the letter from Walden Goggins, his stepdad, when he reads that letter that he wrote to the school. And did you cast Walden Goggins kind of specifically knowing this was going to be against type, because he has played so many villains,
right?
And so for the fact that he ended up being a good guy and wrote that letter was such a surprise. Yes. That was not what I was expecting, and it was so moving to me that that just reading that darn letter, I really liked that part.
Thank you. Well,
and so, yeah, was that kind of by design?
It was by design. And in that case, I have to thank my amazing casting director, John Papsidera, who, you know, we discussed different options for Paul, and he brought up Walton. And then I sort of intuitively saw the idea behind it, because through most of the film, we see Paul, or we experience Paul through Adam's eyes.
Yeah.
So Paul is more like an image, really, that Adam creates. And when that image sort of falls apart and gives way to who the real person is, you know, it worked so well as a prize because of Walton. You know, the other thing is too that the character is very insecure. If you look back at, you know, after you get the reveal and you watch, mm-hmm. you know, to the end of the movie, it's very clear that Paul is someone who doesn't know how to deal with this situation very well. And the letter is a way, you know, he wrote a letter. He didn't spoke out loud. You know, he didn't feel secure enough to sort of.
But it was really, a letter that was in defense of him, of his son,
yeah,
and him claiming him as his son,
yes,
and defending him for these people that had rejected him. And so yes. It was even more than just like, if say he'd written him a letter, the fact that he was defending him as his son, I thought it was just really good.
Yeah, thank you. Also, what I wanted to do is have the letter, and this is very spoilery, obviously, have the letter be read while Charlie, you know, first he understands and then he just gets up and starts running. And the Walton's words combined, I think, with just that like sort of determined, you know, forward motion, this sort of forward pressing of the character that runs downstairs and runs through halls and doesn't stop until he's with Paul. There's something sort of, I guess, inherently moving about that motion to me. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's not really outlined in the book that way, but that's the way I sort of wanted to stage it, because I think like running almost is a cinematic equivalent maybe to singing. It's like expending energy, you know, and you know, yeah. it's as if like the shackles have come off, the emotional shackles have mm-hmm. come off of Charlie, and he now knows, you know. So I think that all sort of worked well in unison together.
I think so too. So you had, when he's experiencing the multiple personalities, you had it'd be sort of a black fog. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you kind of came up with that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not really multiple personalities, because this is not multiple personality disorder. It's sort of giving a sort of filmic physical manifestation to the voices that people with schizophrenia hear. Most of the symptoms are, you know, auditory. Some are visual, so we had that to sort of lean on. But the black sort of fog, I sort of saw it, the sort of origin story, I guess, where the first psychotic break, as Adam puts it, happens in a chemistry class, yeah. in his public school, and they're working with like dissolving liquids in water, which is actually sort of real in the scene if you listen to the teacher. So there's black ink dissolving in water, and he's looking at it, and once the voices sort of overtake him, which I always interpreted as part of the sort of stress trigger of maybe being shut out at home, of, you know, feeling that Paul is taking his place at home, it sort of, you know, gets out of hand. And I felt that maybe that the chemistry class and the visual of that was a nice little visual recurring theme we could use to give, you know, to visualize the voice he's hearing, because it's the only one that is not embodied by an actor, and as such is a little bit more undefined and, you know, nefarious, if you will. So that's where that came from, really, is the this chemical exercise they're doing in class.
Okay, that makes sense. That was really good. I liked it. So yeah, you have the personalities depicted in the film. You have Bodyguard, Darkness, you have
Rebecca and Joaquin. Yeah.
Yes. Right. And I guess that was, were those in the book that way?
Yes, they were. So Rebecca was in the book. The Bodyguard was like sort of more of a mobster. We changed them a little bit from the book. There's also a lot more in the book. Like there's even a choir in the book that sort of sings at very inopportune times in his life. So we felt more like it was beneficial to the movie to pare this down a little bit and use it sparingly and hopefully effectively. But yeah, that's what we did. They were in some shape in the book, and we just kind of reduced them down a little bit. There's a naked man in the book who's sort of, you know, who is very, very inappropriate. And yeah, we morphed him a little bit into Joaquin, you know, who represents the sort of hormonal urges of Adam. Mm-hmm. The challenge with this obviously is, like, as I said, you know, we needed to give the illness a face or a something we could film, you know, something that is like concrete, you know, that also weaves it through the scenes like a character itself, you know, and that supports the notion of what Adam has to deal with. So, you know, they sort of disappear and reappear depending on how he's dealing emotionally with and with his medication and so forth.
I think it worked. I really enjoyed it. And I admire Anna Sophia Robb. I feel like she takes really interesting projects, and for her to take this role, just a secondary role.
Huge privilege for us. Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, she, along with the others, you know, sort of popping in and out, really managed to create a character with not a whole lot of material on the page, give her depth and dimension and, you know, character beats that you know, shortly after you meet them, you sort of know what they're all about, but then they continue to surprise you and with their interactions and how they respond to whatever's happening with Charlie.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed the film, and it's definitely been a very special experience working with Zach and now getting to talk to you. So thank you very much for coming and talking with us and for sharing your experience, and we're excited for any new projects that you have coming up, and you have to keep in touch and let us know what you have.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
What you have coming up. That would be
great. Thank you, Rachel. It's been fun. Thank you.
Do you have a social media that you'd like to share or anything like that?
I have a Twitter account, which is my first and last name. You can check that out. Other than that, I don't have Instagram. Maybe I should have it, but I'm on Facebook as well, which is more sort of a private account, really, but you can probably see it.
Well, I'll put your Twitter in the description. I'll also have in the description the interview with Zach and also my written review. So make sure everybody check that out. I think you'll enjoy it. And the movie you said is coming to digital in November.
Yeah, from what I hear, Lionsgate is putting it out. I think November 10th, but double check on streaming, and then Blu-ray and DVD, I think November 17th, mm-hmm. Shortly thereafter.
Yeah. So definitely take a look at it and let us know after you see it what you think. If you like it, put in the comments section or on Twitter. Let's talk about it. And thanks again. Really appreciate it. And make sure you're all following the Hallmarkies podcast all over social media, iTunes, YouTube. And if you're listening on iTunes, please leave us your ratings and reviews. And if you are listening on YouTube, please give this video a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. We sure appreciate that so much. We also have our Patreon group and merch store. So all that information is in the description. You can follow me at Rachel's Reviews, all over social media, iTunes, YouTube, and on Rotten Tomatoes. You can see all my reviews over there. So thanks again, Tor. I really appreciate this. This was a lot of fun. And we'll talk to you all later. Bye, everyone.